Today, welcome to the Danger Zone. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analysis. I'm the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Friday afternoon, and Tarek Brooker's with me. And boy, we've got a big show today, Tarek.
Oh, we do indeed. Either the longest slideshow ever or the longest one in probably about a year.
But there's so much going on, right? There's so many different aspects of this. But I have to say that some of the things that we've been discussing over recent weeks have really now crystallised quite significantly.
Well, they have indeed. I mean, you know, we've started to see the RBA turn hawkish for a start. I mean, you know, you and I have been, you know, talking about inflation beating the drum, particularly on the issue of, you know, inflation and non-discretionary items. And now all of a sudden, that's pretty much everyone, all anyone can talk about. It's all $11 lettuce. And why has Phil Lowe done this to me when he said in only October we're not raising rates till 2024?
Well, it's an interesting question. Wait for the class action against the Reserve Bank. Is that even feasible? I don't know. But, I mean, he did say just over a month ago it was a bit embarrassing they got the forecast wrong. I think a bit embarrassing is a bit lightweight, right? I mean, a lot of people have actually made decisions based on what he said and, of course, what the previous government said and all of their enthusiasm to go buy property and all of those incentive schemes. It's a very different story now, and I just still feel very concerned about some of those people who walked into this relatively recently. And I know people can say, well, you know, they've got made their own decisions, but they've got to understand that there was a context here, everything from pulling money out of superannuation to go buy a property to the home buyer schemes to all the other bits and pieces, all the other flows of money. Everything was trying to get people to buy. And of course, the banks love that, but it's all going a bit pear-shaped now.
It is, and I mean, it's hard not to feel at least a degree of empathy for people who have, you know, who are you know, on the course for Struggle Street, because, you know, these people who have bought and who have bought under the, well, shall we say, the impression from the bank that they can afford this, that they're going to be able to weather this particular storm. You know, a lot of these people just bought because they just wanted the pain to be over with, because they just wanted to have a home, to have a roof over their head, and to not have to go to an auction and just be outbid again, or, you know, just miss out. I mean, you know, a lot of people, particularly, you know, younger people, you know, Gen Y, Gen Z, you know, they try to get into the market, and it's, you know, our viewers know exactly how challenging that is. You know, to buy a house on a reasonable multiple of an income so that you're insulated against these rate rises, particularly now that we're talking about almost a 4% cash rate, you know, in some of these market projections, you know, it's a pretty tough ask. I mean, you're talking about, you know, needing something at roughly, well, probably, you know, not far off 4 times household income to stay out of mortgage stress if rates do rocket that high.
That's right. And it's quite concerning when you think that a 2% rise is effectively a 30% increase in the average monthly mortgage repayment for a 30-year mortgage, right? That's roughly what it translates to. And whilst many people would have actually been comforting that the banks were looking at, what, the 2.5% or 3% buffer, that 2.5% or 3% buffer was on a very, very low level of assumed spend. Wasn't actually on actual spend. And of course, actual spend has gone through the roof because inflation has been so high. So it really is a bit of a perfect storm, you know, not only interest rates, but these other things too, fuel costs as well as power and other things too. And of course, the worst thing of all is now iceberg lettuce that have gone the same way as loo paper. Can you believe it?
Well, you know, it's just indicative really of where we're at, isn't it? I mean, obviously that there is a myriad of factors why it's so expensive, but it's really just a perfect symbol of the fact that the cost of living for the basics is really getting out of control. And I mean, I know that there's this idea present, particularly, you know, in certain quarters of the finance sector, that, you know, the RBA can't raise rates. Well, look at the price of basics. You know, they're not really going to be left in a position where they have a whole lot of choice. Well, not unless, you know, they want to take the other side of the debate, which is, you know, the Bank of Japan approach, where you try to do something with yields and rates, and then you potentially face the downside to the strength of your currency.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it is. And of course, we are so connected to what the US does through the Fed and Europe as well. And the ECB has now said, well, we're going to have to start lifting rates. They're forecasting inflation above 7%. So everywhere you look, inflation is raging. It's much stronger than people expected. It's not transitory. It's already probably embedded. That means rates are going to go higher. It's going to be a long, slow grind. My own view is this is a 3 to 5 year thing we're going to be dealing with. And that means a lot of people are going to unfortunately get caught in the crossfire, literally.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, if you go by, say, for example, the former RBA governor, you know, Ian McFarlane's recent comments, I believe that they were to the AFR, and, you know, I mean, he's talking about inflation staying at or around 5% for the foreseeable future. And I think, you know, pretty much everyone knows that basically means that if he is correct, we're going to see much, much higher rates well into the future. And I mean, who knows, some of these things about, you know, the market saying, you know, 3.7, 3.9%, well, that might seem dovish in a couple of years' time. We just don't know.
Well, this is worth reflecting on that, ASX forward view of rates, because it's actually been relatively accurate over the last little while, much more accurate than the Reserve Bank's forecast.
Well, much to everyone's surprise, but I mean, Jason Murphy, who's a fellow News.com journalist, he did a great article about basically how often, you know, the market is right, now often the market is wrong when it comes to pricing and rate futures. And admittedly, most of the time the market is wrong. Most of the time the market is far too bullish on where rates are going. But when it comes to actually being in the middle of a hiking cycle, the market is actually surprisingly good at predicting where rates are heading. And that should be ringing some alarm bells in both Canberra and, I imagine, in some households.
Well, you know, people need to still be thinking of rates going higher and preparing. But you've been preparing, and you've been preparing lots of slides. And I know that the real problem is we've got so many things to cover, so we better get into them. Otherwise, we're going to have a mega show on our hands.
Yeah. Yes, we will. So, well, here we go. As usual, the charts are at avidcom.substack.com if you guys would like to take a look. And I just also like to say thank you to everyone who has subscribed and also people who've made some form of contribution. That has been very, very much appreciated. You know who you are. It really helps keep the lights on and helps keeps creating this type of content. So without further ado.
And I have to say, that cartoon is absolutely brilliant. Somebody has a wonderful brain to be able to actually, in a simple picture, just demonstrate that's your problem, mate.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing that I love about it is that they're stuck. You know, they have no choice. They literally have to push the button.
Exactly right. It's hilarious, isn't it? Yeah, okay.
All right, let's do it. Okay, today is something a little bit different. We're going to be going with a little bit more of a Tony Lecantro approach, with a little bit of comment, a little bit more written commentary rather than just solely the slides. But we'll get to that in the not too distant future.
And I warn you, I'm going to be playing bingo with you as well as I did with Lecantro if you start going down that route. Okay.
Well, why not? Okay. Well, first off, I thought we'd do a little bit of history on previous financial and economic crisis. In 1996, 1997, we had the Asian financial crisis, which, you know, it took a wrecking ball to over-indebted Asian economies with high levels of household debt. And it just really, in a lot of cases, smashed their currencies. It unleashed inflation. It created all manner of problems. But it was relatively contained within Asia. There were some spillovers within financial markets, but it didn't cause a global recession and it didn't unleash the same sort of havoc that other financial crises have that came later. For example, in 2008, the global financial crisis, it echoed around the world, but the US was the epicenter. The US faced a protracted recession, but China powered through and other nations around the world bounced back relatively quickly. Then it was Europe's turn in 2011 and 2012, when they got hit with the Eurozone debt crisis, which was also relatively contained to Europe. There was a bit of a hit in financial markets, but it didn't really take off and spread in the same way that the financial crisis did. The US economy was powering out of recession at that point, and China powered ahead as well. So in all of these previous crises, other parts of the global economy have been getting ahead, have been doing okay. The problem now is if we face multiple problems all at the same time. Now, we're generally used to having at least one growth engine of the economy functioning, like a plane. You can fly, you know, a four-engine plane on one engine, you can still land it safely. But when all the engines stop, to once again go back to an analogy that Martin and I've used in the past, well, that's when you get into trouble with a soft landing. Around the world, there are so many different issues, whether they're created by the war, whether they're created by the pandemic, or whether they're just underlying problems. There may no longer be a sufficiently potent growth engine of last resort, and that risks a crisis. Once a major crisis kicks off, that then blowing up into other smaller crises and into even just a larger, broader crisis around the world. And then we'll get into a few of the potentials. There's, of course, the potential for an inflationary global recession, whereby inflation remains strong. Despite the fact that you could see a recession, it doesn't return to the target band quickly enough, which either forces the central banks to continue to remain hawkish or to let inflation run, which then risks it becoming even further embedded.
You're absolutely on the right key here. One interesting question, which I'll just throw in now, was what happens if we actually don't get growth? What happens if effectively we have to actually say the concept of growth is in the past and maybe it's never going to come back? And then if you overlay the climate crisis and, you know, the overpopulation crisis, maybe this is actually now the end of the growth story. And if that's the case, boy, we're in a whole new ball game.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, you know, there's also, you know, just to add more to what you were saying, there's also the demographic side of things as well. You know, we are heading to that period of, to the end of that period of easy growth. Europe has already experienced it. You know, so has Japan. And, you know, now China is as well. So, you know, you're absolutely right that we may need to re-examine growth and economic outcomes in general. And to be honest, I think that would be a good thing.
Well, you know, there was a report recently, I think it was it from the World Bank or maybe it was from the United Nations, somebody, but basically said we're consuming three planets worth of stuff.
Yeah.
Right? Three planets worth for one planet's worth of people. That's a problem.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely right. And I mean, you know, so just to go back to the slides, the thing, one of the issues with the, say, for example, there's the, you know, with consuming so much is that it takes a lot of debt to consume so much because you're not creating enough productive capacity in the now to be able to afford all that consumption. So for example, there's the threat of a Eurozone debt crisis again, because the ECB wants to raise rates. The market is now pricing in a 2.3% ECB market rate by the end of 2023. Now, that kind of makes an Aussie, you know, any idea of an Aussie cash rate peaking under 2% seem a little bit silly without some form of major recession. And then there's obviously the potential for a US recession. You know, the current GDP nowcast from the Atlanta Fed is predicting just as little as 0.2% quarter-on-quarter growth for Q2. So it's already borderline. And then there's obviously issues with commercial mortgage-backed securities because people haven't gone back to the office. There's the issues of the US housing market, which is now as overvalued as it was in 2008 by some measures. Issues with junk bonds, which have you know, sort of taken off in recent years. And then there's also the issues with pension funds.
And I will just add there, Tarek, that one of the other issues, of course, is that the debt that companies are relying on is now a lot more expensive than it was. And so what they'll be doing is having to replace cheap debt with expensive debt going forward. That's also true of governments, not least the US government.
No, absolutely. Those refinancing costs have gotten a hell of a lot bigger. I mean, I think, did you happen to see the issuance of the bonds by Carnival Cruise Lines by any chance?
I did. I was thinking of that. Rather expensive, huh?
Very, very expensive. You know, paying much, much higher rates, only issuing bonds just a few months later, just because the game has changed so much.
Yeah, exactly. And we're going to see a lot more of that. And that's why a lot of the tech firms, of course, are very much now on the nose, because they are reliant on cheap debt to be able to actually make their business models work and to ultimately maybe make money in the future. And it also discounts more heavily any revenue in the future. So that's another reason why those are there too. This is why I think we're at this nexus point where there are so many potential risks of never seeing the world quite the same again.
No, exactly. I mean, I think in some ways that the pandemic marked the end of that particular world. you know, some things may have returned, but I think we are going to see a new changed world yet again in a lot of different ways. But to move on to the next point, China is still struggling, for better or worse. Parts of Shanghai went back into a de facto lockdown today. That took some of the heat out of oil prices. The virus isn't going away. You know, they're throwing absolutely trillions of yuan at the problem, and yet growth forecasts still keep being downgraded. Commodity prices are still high. So the scope for them to engage in the same type of stimulus that bailed out the world, and in particular Australia in 2008, is a lot lower. Because if they throw all the money at it, all of a sudden they're going to create inflation in commodity prices, and they're going to get a whole lot less bang for their buck.
And of course, the property sector continues to crash, and Evergrande and others are looking even more sickly than they were.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the untold stories. You know, just because Evergrande didn't blow up like Lehman Brothers, and the Chinese property sector didn't go nuclear like US investment banks back in 2008, it doesn't mean the problem's been solved. It's still deteriorating in the background. And there hasn't. And I think one of the key things that for people to remember is there hasn't been a bailout. The Chinese government's been tinkering around the edges, and these property firms are still defaulting and they're still falling over.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because the fallout continues with property prices continuing to slide, number of transactions on property still going down in China, and more people now worried about whatever wealth they had because it's dissipating quite fast.
Indeed. And, you know, I mean, say, not too far away in Japan, there's the issue of the fact that they're trying to cap yields. You know, they're trying to cap yields. The yen is falling rapidly against the US dollar. And Kuroda, who is the chairman of the Bank of Japan, is, you know, he doesn't have a plan. He just keeps pressing on the same line again and again and again, even though I believe the other day it was surveyed that 73% of Japanese companies now believe that the falling yen is bad for business. So this isn't a positive growth story for Japanese exporters. It's just a complete mess of a situation that the Japanese find themselves in.
Well, the old definition of insanity, you keep doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome. Well, the Japanese story is do the same thing and you get the same outcome.
Well, in a way, I suppose we Australians should be thankful because it shows the RBA what will happen if they try yield curve control again.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think they'll ever try that again, but that's a whole new different story.
Oh, indeed. And then there's also the issue with Russia, you know, with them maintaining their oil infrastructure, despite the fact that they no longer have access to the spare parts and the ingenuity and the know-how of the global oil industry. Now, if they start capping these wells, it's going to take a lot to get those wells going again, as it did after the fall of the Soviet Union. So that could cut global oil production capabilities on a permanent, or at the very least, a protracted basis, driving oil prices higher in the long term. And those are just a few of the potential crises that the world faces. And the risk now is that one blows up, and it risks all the others popping off at the same time. You know, a bit like watching one of those ammo depots in Ukraine all going up at once. And that's really the risk going forward, not just one crisis, but all of them going off at once, because there is no longer the easy way out. There is no longer that global growth driver of last resort that we've had in past crises. And that's what makes this particular set of circumstances so concerning.
Well, I believe there was an interesting speech given by somebody at Davos making the point that people around the world, you know, people in power around the world are very bad at doing multiple things at the same time. They tend to sort of jump from issue to issue to issue, and we'll focus on COVID and then we'll focus, you know. What this is demonstrating the complexity of real life, right? All of these things are interconnected, and it's like a bit like a game of Jenga, right? And you're sort of messing around with stuff down here, and you're not quite sure how that's going to impact the stuff up there, right? And that's how I feel about this. And I'll also make the other point that the oil situation is really going to actually change the trajectory with regard to renewables and how much the focus should be on renewables. Because on one hand, you might suddenly find that everybody now is going to open up the oil fields, like up in the UK, off, you know, looking at the the North Sea. They're now talking about starting drilling and starting to get more oil out of the North Sea rather than where they were going previously, right, on one hand. Or you might go a different way, which is to say, right, well, this is a catalyst to trying to get out of the oil game at all and then invest big in renewables and everything else. Neither of those two are comfortable routes, right? It's a really, really complex thing. And then the final point I want to say over all of this, I keep coming back to the millions of people who are starving or will be starving because of the food fallout from all of this. And you know, it's okay perhaps talking about Western countries and what's going on in Australia, but I'm very concerned about a lot of those other countries around the world who are really seeing food prices spike, grain not now accessible. And again, at Davos and at elsewhere, people were really worried about the global impact on societies.
Yeah. And that sort of leads me to something that I've been hearing in certain circles from some very well-connected people, that basically inflation is now the number one priority. Markets don't matter anymore. Even to a degree, economies don't matter anymore, because it's inflation that destroys societies, that destroys civilizations, and has plenty of times in the past. Because one of the poorly misunderstood things about inflation from a global and particularly from an emerging market perspective is inflation doesn't need to get any worse.
Yep.
It's bad enough as it is. It is bad. If this continues as it stands, it is going to blow up governments. It is going to blow up nations. It really is that simple. You know, governments are already expending enormous amounts of resources to subsidize energy, to subsidize food, to do all these different things to keep their society stable. If we see prices continue to rise, if we see oil prices, gas prices, food prices continue to go to the moon, you know, this is going to cause probably one of the greatest upheavals in modern human history, at least in the past. Well, probably since, at least since the collapse of the Soviet Union, and possibly since the collapse of the empires before that. So it's a real messy situation. And I really don't think that a lot of people in the West have a full appreciation of not only how bad it could get in these countries, but the knock-on effects that it could have for all of us, for the commodities, for the manufacturing, for all these things that could be disrupted as a result.
No, absolutely. It's like it's a game of dominoes, right? You knock the first one over and then the second thing falls and the third thing. We're only thinking about the first or second or third, right? But we've got to be thinking much further ahead here, because the consequences, both from a societal perspective and from an environmental perspective and from an economic perspective, are pretty dire. And you know, a lot of people say, oh, you're being doom and gloom again, you know, and let's remind everybody, well, you know, we were talking a few months ago about the risk of inflation and the fact that rates will probably, we've actually been calling this, I think, reasonably well in recent times, not wanting to blow my own trumpet particularly or yours, but the fact is, if we don't actually see the big picture and see some of the connected issues that are here, we're going to make more policy errors, and the, you know, central banks are going to make more policy errors. And I worry that we're going to see tactical things being done by governments trying to sort of put a finger in the dike without actually getting to the fundamental structural issues that we are absolutely uncovering here.
No, exactly. And the truth is that a lot of these problems that we currently face have been created by the West.
Yep.
And if you go out and you go past the smiles and the tourism commercial type stuff out into the rest of the developing world, you know, don't get me wrong, there's an appreciation that people are there, that Westerners are going there, that they're helping their economies, but there's a lot of anger and frustration at the fact that the West has created this mess for them.
Yep.
You know, and that is not a good thing. You know, and I don't know, like, It seems to me that politicians have got this, they're already stuck in a very Western-centric view of the world, but then they're stuck in an even more myopic and ivory tower-esque version of what the rest of us see. So I don't know. It's just, it's going to get painfully messy for a lot of people. And I really do feel for them.
Well, I think, you know, the Friedman philosophy of where economies work are really being questioned here. And, you know, maybe big debt actually was a mistake, and maybe all this quantitative easing and everything else and low interest rates was a mistake. And it was based on a false set of predicates about the way the economy works. And again, going back to what Ian McFarlane said, questioning what the Reserve Bank is doing. But there was another article in the AFR from Andrew Mole, but he basically said, this shows you that throwing a lot of money in, you know, and just taking rates down and applying the MMT school of motoring has created a bigger problem than ever. Now, my argument to that would be, well, yeah, but it depends what you do with the money. We didn't do the right things with the money we created. We just sort of perpetuated the old school. But, you know, there are huge fractures here, and they are really deep and really structural. And the question is, do we have leaders around the world who are willing and able and capable of dealing with this complexity?
No.
Oh dear,
no,
right.
No. I mean, realistically, no. I mean, you look at the Biden administration, for example. You know, they made a mess of getting baby formula of the baby formulas the thing. You know, I mean, they could have you know, gone to the Defense Productions Act months ago. You know, kickstarted the domestic production, started importing it from Europe. You know, removed the various barriers that were in and red tape that was in place, and made sure that Americans' children didn't go hungry.
Yeah,
they were warned. They did nothing. Well, not nothing. They did. They made a very minimal effort. And I mean, if that's what they're going to do to feed children, you know, I don't really have a whole lot of faith that they're going to manage to see the bigger picture. I mean, kudos to some that have. I will say, you know, I will single out, say, Emmanuel Macron, who has been talking about the issue with the food crisis, with all this other stuff since before the invasion of Ukraine. And, you know, kudos to him for that. But that's only one man in one country who's preparing for it, not the other, you know, 200 odd.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's right. And I make the other point. There is still the alibi of the Ukraine-Russian war being used and rolled out again and again and again, right? A lot of these things were actually seeded well before Russia and Ukraine had their conflict, right? This has been probably 10 or 15 years in the making, and the whole fundamental philosophical structure of the way that people thought things worked and what things should work are actually being questioned. And the problem I see partly is this incremental thinking. You know, we'll just do a little bit here and a little bit there, right? And nothing radical, nothing to shake to sort of shake the boat, as it were. And that has really taken us into this sort of blind alley. And, you know, there was a wonderful cartoon, I'm not sure that you showed it to me, but somebody did, which showed the Federal Reserve trapped between inflation on one side and, you know, rates on the other side, and, well, nowhere to move. And that's a bit like where we got to.
Yeah, pretty much. And I mean, it's just, it's really quite painful to watch. But I mean, you know, as a, in some ways, we're just passengers on the ride, you know. It's a bit like the Hotel California. We can check out anytime we like, but we can never leave.
Exactly right. But we can see where we're heading, and maybe, you know, hey, we'll get back to the slides, I guess. Otherwise, yeah, we're going to be here for 3 years.
Probably, mate. Well, this is that ASX cash rate future thing that you, graph that you were mentioning earlier. And basically, the market is now pricing in a much higher terminal cash rate of about 3.7%. It was pricing in one as high as 3.9% when the market got shocked on Tuesday, but it's looking about 3.7% at the moment. This has forced CBA to, as you can see on the left, to adjust their forecast now above 2%. But, you know, rates are going higher.
Yeah, and it's worth just reflecting, of course, that as we said, you know, the markets, well, they take a view, but there is a similar trajectory in a lot of other markets too, right? So this is actually not just an Australian thing. You know, you can look at the US or you can look at Europe, and everyone is saying rates are going higher. And I just underscore the quantum of debt that we've got around the world is huge. This is going to put a huge financial burden on those, be they governments, be they corporates, or be they households, in terms of just servicing the very large debts that they've got. And of course, one of the fundamental points here is that debt has been seen to be the silver bullet to solve everything. And now maybe the silver bullet is turned around, just like the earlier chart, and sort of coming back behind us.
Yeah, it's a fairly substantial problem. And I mean, you know, just like you were saying about the fact that this is a global issue.
Yep.
You know, if the ECB does indeed raise 50 basis points in July, it's going to be pretty hard for the RBA not to follow. You know, I mean, 50 basis points is the new 25. So, you know, it's really going to be quite an issue for the RBA to to be able to pull back from this.
Yeah, I sort of had a few people ask me, well, why doesn't the RBA just take its own route? And I said, well, you can't. We're connected, right? Our economy is connected to what happens in Europe, the US, New Zealand, other places too, right? And if we get too far out of kilter, then, of course, the exchange rate and the dollar just, you know, goes through the floor. So we have to actually almost, I would suggest, ape what other central bank organizations do around the world. And I would argue, actually, what we've been doing here in Australia is aping what the Fed's been doing and what other people have been doing.
Yeah, exactly. We're just on a little bit of a delay, and now we're catching up.
Yep.
This one really speaks for itself. You know, this is the Melbourne Institute's month-on-month inflation gauge. It recently hit 1.1% month-on-month, which is the highest reading in the history of the series. So, you know, more inflation ahead. That's something that both the RBA and also our new treasurer have been talking about, that the worst is yet to come.
Yes, and it's rather interesting hospital pass to the new incumbents, isn't it? To say, well, yeah, you know, Frydenberg was saying, what, just before the election, the economy's in fine fettle, you know, and ScoMo was too. Well, hang on, maybe not. And the other point, of course, here is that now there are some base effects in some of these inflation numbers, right? So, you know, the question is, will prices go on, continue to go up, or will they plateau? At the moment, you know, a lot of them, like oil and gas and electricity, is still going up. So that would suggest that inflation has yet more trajectory ahead of itself.
Indeed, and I think you make an interesting point regarding the electricity and the energy side of things, because even if we do manage to somehow get other aspects of inflation under control, it's going to be pretty hard sell turning dovish if electricity prices and food prices are still going to the moon.
Mm. Well, it's all embedded, you see. I mean, you know, transport costs and energy costs are embedded in the cost of production. And you look at everything from food and, you know, other goods that are manufactured, whether they're manufactured here or internationally, and they're transported around the world. Those costs are going to continue to actually be sticky, which means that effectively whatever you like, whatever happens to wages, by the way, and I'm not convinced as many people that we're going to see strong wages growth ahead, particularly now, those are stuck. And they're stuck. And then because, of course, there is this very complicated machinery whereby somebody makes a part and then that part goes across somewhere else and then it's put into a machine and the machine then actually makes something else and it goes somewhere else, right? So at every stage, what you're doing is you're adding more inflation into the cost of the end good. So it doesn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me if we saw inflation way higher for a way lot longer. And I still believe that this is a 3 to 5 year thing we're going to live through.
Well, you make an interesting point in that regard, because, I mean, you know, we spoke about this, I think it was a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, about the issue with inventory builds in the US. You know, we are seeing inventory builds, we are seeing discounting, but that doesn't mean that inflation up the supply chain, you know, at a matter of manufacturer's level is slowing down, because it isn't. It's still remaining a major issue. So you're seeing the simultaneous coexistence of inflationary factors in some parts of the economy,
yep,
and disinflation and deflationary factors at the in elements of retail,
yep,
which is just a perfect storm really for corporate earnings getting hit with like a hit with a hammer.
Yeah, and I still have this view that with credit availability being tightened and interest rates rising and, you know, less credit in the system, there is still a very strong risk of a deflationary force coming through subsequent, right? So, you know, maybe the inflationary thing is the current demon that we're trying to slay, but it's not the only one we've got to think about. We've got to think about beyond that too, because the momentum in the economy will potentially slide away. The growth of credit will go negative, which means people are paying down credit rather than actually taking more credit. That's all deflationary. So there's still a deflationary future just over the horizon if we're not careful too.
Yeah, it's definitely a complex situation, you know, with all you know, all these legion of possibilities are well and truly on the table. I mean, you know, we spoke about the deflationary stuff, you know, even last year, and
yep,
you know, it is on the table. But I mean, it's just a case of, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, sometimes I think we're going to see a little bit of a yo-yo effect.
Yeah.
You know, that we're going to see this inflation. We're going to see, you know, eventually they're going to be forced to crush the inflation by whatever means necessary. You will see those deflationary factors, but then they might just stimulate and send inflation back to the moon again anyway.
Correct. Yeah, well, that goes back to the point of, you know, is QE parked and will it be reactivated. And the yo-yoing is part of the problem, it seems to me, because, you know, we seem to overshoot, undershoot, overshoot, undershoot. Part of that is the lag, right? Because it takes months for a lot of these things, the policy rates, to sort of flow through to the economy. And, you know, whilst we're already seeing some impact on house prices, chances are we're going to see more impact ahead. So there is a lag. And when the Reserve Bank is saying, well, we're watching the data and we're going to make decisions based on the data, well, it's a bit tough because it takes 3 to 6 months for their policy decision to flow through to the economy. And yet next month they've got to make a decision.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. And that you know, perfect example, you know, consumer confidence. I mean, you know, while there is the lag in terms of the actual impact of monetary policy feeding through on the economy, feeding through on households, there is the impact on confidence. But the problem with looking at confidence levels is that generally in the past, they've been very, very useful in determining, you know, how the economy was faring, how retail would fare, how people would spend. But now, as you can see, you know, I mean, with the excluding the impact of the initial shock of the pandemic, confidence is lower now than it has been in well over a decade. Yet, if you look at the ABS retail sales, even if you adjust them for inflation, people are still out there spending. So it's a really, really complex picture in that regard. And I think that that may keep the RBA hawkish longer than they otherwise would be because of that lag and because of the fact that they just don't know what's going to happen.
That's right. And the consumer confidence and the business confidence are both relatively negative at the moment. So it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out. And look, I have the view that this confidence stuff is quite important because the psychology of people is really important to understand. So, you know, housing is driven partly by rates, but it's also driven by psychology, and a lot of other things are too. And this suggests to me that we are going to see a lot of uncertainty. And one of the things that people do in that situation is just keep the wallet in the pocket rather than go spend.
Indeed. This is just, yeah, basically, you know, the CBA recently cut the GDP forecast basically in half to a little over 2% for 2022. And, you know, the AIG services PMI has rolled over in earnest. And, you know, it just goes to show that we do have a slowing economy here in Australia.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm afraid there's more evidence of it slowing. And in fact, the services sector particularly is the one now hardest hit, right? Which is surprising. So,
indeed. Now onto the US, and this chart is as useful as it is concerning. And basically it just shows that, you know, 45% of American parents reportedly are skipping meals to feed their kids. Now, you know, we can talk about how correct this is or whether it's biased or whatever, but if anything in that ballpark is in any way true, America is in some fairly dire straits in that regard at a sort of, you know, middle and lower class level. Now, it's all well and good to say, oh, but spending's holding up and this and that, but, you know, it's really a profoundly not good thing.
And that last one's quite interesting. The family skip meals, that's gone up from 5% to 9% in a very short period of time. Right. Yeah. It's the rate of change which is really concerning. And we know that quite a few people are literally living, you know, from paycheck to paycheck, or worse still, living beyond their means already. And one of the issues there is if you look whether debt is actually still rising and the buy now, pay later stuff is still rising, it's often with these households who are struggling, trying to work out how to actually make things that don't work, work.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll get to some households who are living beyond their means in the next few slides. It's honestly just, it's disturbing, really. You know, you look at charts like this and you go, people on $100,000 to $150,000 US dollars a year, millennials, 63% of them are living paycheck to paycheck.
Yep.
Now you can say, oh, it's just silly Gen Y, Gen Z, blah, blah, blah. But even boomers, more than, you know, depending on the particular income demographic, more than a fifth are living paycheck to paycheck. But the thing I like about this chart is that it illustrates that the economy is built on fundamentally unsound foundations. Because if people turn around after the next recession, after the next crisis, whenever that may be, and decide, crap, I really need to be more prudent. I need to have a rainy day fund. I need to save more money. I need to be a little bit more prudent. What's going to happen to the economy? The economy is built on these people, all these, you know, these millions and millions and millions of people going out and blowing their entire paycheck week in, week out. Yep. If that changes, it fundamentally changes the makeup of the economy.
Yeah, no, it does. Yeah, absolutely. And the point there, of course, is it's debt-driven, right? So a lot of what's been going on has been debt-driven for a long, long time, with interest rates going lower and lower and lower and lower, and people actually living in the environment where rates only went lower. That's now changing. And there is a fundamental philosophical point here about amount of consumption, the driver of consumption, and how you fund it, right? And if that changes, and it looks to me as though it could well be changing now, I see that in my surveys too, that's a fundamentally different worldview for the financial system, for the tax system, and also for the economy more generally.
Yeah, exactly. It's a complete paradigm shift. It's, you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It's, you know, start from scratch. So, you know, we just don't know what's going to happen in that regard. And, you know, if we do start to see these, you know, structural changes occurring within households, you know, there's no telling when those changes will end. I mean, in some ways, it's a little bit like the Great Depression.
Yep.
You know, that scarred generations of people. It made them savers. It made them prudent. If we see something similar now, it's going to very much change the growth makeup and the economic makeup of our society.
Especially if the stock markets continue to go down, as many people are forecasting they will, because that's the other barometer of wealth, right? You know, house prices going down, the stock markets going down, suddenly people feel less secure. You know, it's exactly the same. And people keep talking to me about the echoes of the, you know, Great Depression. Well, there are some horrible echoes here.
Indeed. Now, this is for a specific type of US home equity withdrawals, which is the cash out refinance. There are other options, I should emphasize. However, I quite like this because it basically just shows that this particular version of EquityMate has collapsed by 40% in a month. due to rocketing rates. And I should also say that this actually predates the collapse in US mortgage activity. US mortgage demand has dropped to its lowest level in 22 years. So EquityMate has been, in this particular avenue, has been taken out the back and shot in the head. Now, if you were to somehow impose that on the entirety of home equity withdrawals in Australia, you're talking about ripping out almost 2% of GDP in a month. So it just goes to show, once rates rise and once housing price expectations begin to change, how quickly home equity withdrawals can go out of vogue.
Well, I'll tell you something. I was talking to somebody the other day who's got some financial troubles at the moment, and they were talking to the bank a couple of months ago, and the bank made a suggestion of pulling more money out of their property because they had some equity in the property, and basically increase their mortgage to be able to actually deal with some of their debts, right? The bank turned around to them last week and said, sorry, we can't do that anymore.
Ooh, there you go. It certainly would change things dramatically for the Australian economy if that were to be repeated on a widespread scale, because home equity withdrawals here in Australia are worth 4.65% of GDP.
I know. It's huge.
It is truly huge. Enormous. You know, America, I read this article the other day talking about the risks in the US of home equity withdrawals reversing, because they'd risen to almost 1% of GDP. And here we are at 4.5 times that, and it barely rates a mention.
No. And, you know, if you think about responsible lending obligations, et cetera, you've got to question how much of that was actually well withdrawn and well invested.
Exactly. I mean, obviously, you know, there's the people who just pull it out and have it sit there, you know, in the offset, et cetera. But, you know, you really do wonder how much of the economy's growth, particularly over the last 12 to 18 months, has been driven by that. Because you're talking about something that, you know, as we've discussed in the past, is bigger than JobKeeper.
Absolutely. Scariest times, yep.
One of the things I quite like about the US manufacturing PMI is when you break it down into the various different components, because it's all and good to look at the headline and go, oh, well, that looks pretty good. You know, it's 56. It's, you know, it's a reasonably healthy number despite being in a downtrend. But when you look at the new orders, which is often a forward-looking indicator for the US manufacturing sector, for the manufacturing sector more broadly, that's now fallen into contraction. And the manufacturing sector was, you know, arguably the powerhouse pushing the US economy along in recent months, even though it had a negative first quarter. So it's going to be quite interesting to see how the US economy fares going forward.
It certainly will be.
This is what I was referencing before. Basically, the US economy is on the teetering on the edge of recession. It had a negative first quarter. You know, admittedly, that was largely due to the finicky way that GDP works in terms of net exports and imports, etc. But it doesn't really matter. A recession is a recession is a recession. So unless the reversing situation in exports, the trade balance can come to the rescue, it's looking pretty borderline as to whether or not the US could fall into recession in the not too distant future.
And the latest economic surveys suggest that more people are now betting on a recession rather than not.
Yeah, it's looking pretty dire out there. And yep. You know, I mean, searches for recession on Google are going up, and that's never a good sign.
No, exactly.
Okay, this is US gasoline inventories. And one of the things I think is really interesting about this is basically US oil refineries are running hot. They are running at near full capacity once you factor in, you know, the fact that there needs to be downtime for maintenance, et cetera, et cetera. Yet despite them running hot, despite them pumping out all this gasoline, all these other distillates, jet fuel, diesel, et cetera, gasoline stocks continue to fall, which continues to put upward pressure on US gasoline prices, which are expected to hit an average of $5 a gallon either later today or tomorrow, based on the current margin pressures. And that is a really, really important thing for US inflation, because you can have inflation moderate to 4%, but if gas prices are still $5 plus a gallon, you're going to see political pressure to address inflation.
Yeah, it's interesting because in the UK, they've now just started talking about paying more than £100 just to fill up a standard car with petrol in the UK, which is higher than it's ever been. And that's getting political focus and attention now as well. And of course, everybody's saying that it's going to go higher. And some of the survey works that I've seen recently is showing that people are traveling less, they're filling up less, and, you know, people are just hunkering down because these costs are so huge.
Yeah, exactly. And we are headed for that type of, we're heading for a recession. Yep. On what global scale it will be and what ends up blowing up in the process is what's open to interpretation, but we are headed for a recession. And I mean, even just to take the UK as an example, I mean, you know, the British Chamber of Commerce came out the other day and they said they expect double-digit inflation by the end of the year. And I mean, that's truly insane. I mean, you know, people saying, oh, inflation is peaking. Well, not so much, you know, in some places.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's worth just recalling again from the UK, they looked at the inflation pressures on low-income households who are spending a lot more than average on, you know, standard things like shopping and what have you. And the inflation there is already a lot higher than it is across the board. And that's the other point. It's not equally spread across the economy. You know, you don't have to buy another, you know, flat screen TV. You only got one of those already, but you have to eat and you have to, you know, pay for electricity. So those lower income households are actually right in the crosshairs of this inflationary spurt.
Absolutely. Another interesting little just tidbit for the gasoline demand side of things. Basically, it just shows that the demand for gasoline in the US is still below 2019 levels on a seasonally adjusted basis. So we are still seeing demand destruction, as you mentioned, from people driving less. I mean, part of that is obviously the work from home phenomenon, etc. But the fact that you're still seeing upward pressure on gasoline prices, despite the fact that the demand is still significantly lower, really bodes quite poorly, particularly if Americans do set off in droves for their summer vacations and their summer road trips, as some have expected.
Absolutely, and they probably still will, because that's what they always do. And remember the November midterms? This could become a significant issue.
Exactly. And Biden is going to continue to beat the drum on inflation. I mean, he called Yellen and Powell up to the Hill a few weeks ago, you know, drummed into them inflation. And I do think it's quite funny because people keep saying, oh, well, what about the market? It's like, well, they don't care about the market. No, not correct. Right now.
No, exactly. And that he's been very clear, you know, he's okay to see the markets fall because his major focus is inflation.
Yeah. This one is an interesting one from a good Twitter follower, Alessio Urban, who posts a number of these different charts. And basically it shows that despite the fact that spot rates for shipping are falling on a long-term basis, long-term contracts are still rising. So that's really quite an interesting one because, you know, that may well be the sort of canary in the coal mine for the cost of shipping, because if that keeps going, you are going to still see inflationary pressures from the shipping sector, from elements to the shipping sector. And also to be looking for when that does eventually roll over, because that could really be the be-all and end-all peak.
And part of that is because of the inefficiency in the shipping supply chains, right? Because people are still parked in various places and it's taking a lot longer and it's costing a lot more, of course, as well, in terms of actually the fuel that's required. And the more that I get into this and the more that I speak to people who know, they're saying that the supply chain, the international shipping supply chains, are broken and will be broken not for months, but for years.
Yeah. And I've heard similarly from a number of different people, you know, both in the industry and, you know, analysts who specialize in that particular, you know, sort of subset of global trade. And if it is broken for a long, long time to go, the question is what is it going to take to fix it or to unbreak it? And one wonders, you know, looking at all these different factors, all of a sudden a deflationary recession is actually starting to look pretty good in terms of inadvertently solving some of these problems.
Well, I've said, and I'll say again, deflation is still there in the background, like it or not.
Well, I mean, it's just to the point that it's actually becoming somewhat desirable. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, central banks would like a deflationary recession because that means they could fire up the money printer again.
They need an excuse.
Oh, well, exactly. This is another one for the oil side of things. And basically, we're still seeing global air passenger volumes still significantly below pre-COVID levels. And if that continues to return to pre-COVID levels, you know, more demand for oil.
Well, we'll see. Yeah. I wonder whether this traffic will continue to grow or whether it will actually tail off again, right? I'm not, you know, the peak traffic travel over this weekend, lots of queues, lots of people in Europe having horrendous journeys. Well, we'll see.
Yeah, well, that's the other side of the coin, isn't it? You know, yeah. I mean, the demand may be there, but will the shall we say, the supply to deliver a reasonable experience be there?
Exactly.
Okay. I quite like this one because it shows there was recently an explosion at a US LNG plant, which accounts for about 20% of recent US LNG exports. And as a result, US natural gas prices fell because there was all that extra supply was now trapped within the US system, and EU natural gas prices rose, because that means that there's going to be less LNG on offer to be exported to Europe. And the Twitter account Doomberg, which I heartily recommend, made the excellent point that you cannot run heavy industry at near full capacity. Because when you do, when you skip the maintenance, when you skip the downtime, things break. And then they create even more problems like we're seeing now.
I'm talking about things break, things like generating capacity running at full bore and falling over when you don't maintain it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. You know, it's these little things, you know, these otherwise, you know, in a normal sort of environment, you go, oh, that thing blew up. Oh, well, you know, we'll deal with it. It's not that big of an issue. But when you're already having an energy crisis And this, and just for the record, this is part of a long list of other things, you know, from food processing plants all the way through to factories that have had industrial accidents or fires or issues as a result of a lack of, I'm not saying necessarily that this one is, but just in general that have occurred due to a lack of maintenance or running hot. There's a long list of them. And the more that this type of thing happens, the more that you run these systems at levels of capacity that they're not designed to cope with over the long term, the more you're going to have problems.
Yeah, something's going to break somewhere.
Pretty much. And this is probably the most important chart, so I left it for last. And basically it shows that food prices have not caught up with fertilizer prices. And basically that there is still a whole heap of upside, or should I say upside for prices, downside for humanity in terms of food prices going forward. The full impact of rising fertilizer costs, rising diesel costs has not been fully priced into food prices as of yet.
Mm. Upside for farmers, maybe, maybe not, because some farmers are actually trying to make the trade-off between do I put more or less fertilizer on because it's so expensive versus the returns I'm going to get. And if the crop prices aren't following, they're probably not going to put as much fertilizer on, which means they're going to be less productive.
Yeah, exactly, which will eventually spike crop prices it'll outstrip, you know, demand will outstrip supply.
Yeah.
But then that causes more problems in terms of starvation and hunger and all those horrible things around the world. So it's an absolute nightmare of a situation. And it's, you know, unfortunately, it may get worse before it gets better.
Well, the old butterfly effect, right? You know, a little thing over here can have a big impact over there. And when you've got lots of perpetrations in lots of different places all going off in different directions, the combined wave effect of all of those are very hard to predict. And that's one of the reasons why it's very hard to forecast going forward.
Yeah, it's honestly just a real mess out there. And, you know, the part of the problem is that generally speaking, political leaders wait until these issues become full-blown crises before they act. Now, admittedly, in issues such as this, there really isn't a whole heap they can do to magic up more food or magic up more fertilizer. But, you know, there are things that they can be doing. You know, that there's, you know, programs that we can undergo to make sure that we, you know, that these countries don't blow up, that there's at least enough for the basics, you know, say, for example, even between India and Egypt, they've worked out a bilateral trade agreement, which is basically based on barter, where India supplies crops and Egypt provides fertilizer, because, you know, at least then they're both getting what they need. And I feel like that's the type of thing that, particularly with the fragmented state of the world geopolitically, with sanctions, et cetera, that's the type of thing that we need. These types of, you know, sort of bilateral deals where we can make sure that everyone has what they need to the best of our ability.
But what you're actually highlighting, I think, if you stand back, I think this is the failure of globalization, isn't it? We're actually seeing the fragmented state of relationships, supply chains, financial markets. This is a whole new world.
It is, and we've had a bit of this discussion before, but it's like the crisis of the 14th century. Things have changed. The crisis of the 14th century basically occurred because the climatic conditions that were present during the 13th century came to an end. You know, the ideal time for building societies, growing crops, growing populations, etc. came to a relatively abrupt end over a number of different years. And now we're seeing the same thing. You know, we've got issues with climate change impacting crop yields. We've got issues with basically too much demand for food, too large a population to be able to feed. And there's no slack in the system in the same way that there wasn't in the 14th century. And that's the problem. And back then we ended up with protectionism. We ended up with countries looking after themselves. We ended up with social unrest and eventually major wars and civil wars. And we're starting to see those sorts of things now. And it's frustrating, frankly, to watch history repeat itself when really some of these issues were obvious quite long ago. But, you know, they're not addressing them are not conducive to the current approach to growth and economics that currently defines our world.
Mm, and I also suggest to you that the World Economic Forum and the United Nations, all those other laudable bodies, right, have actually failed, because basically, you know, they might still be preaching, you know, to the Davos set and everything else, this stuff, but actually in the real world, the fragmentation is already happening, and I don't think we're going to ever be able to climb back up to where that was, whether it was good or bad. But we haven't yet defined what the next state of the world is, and we don't have much time, actually, because the runway is getting a bit short. And in the meantime, I think people are going to get caught in the crossfire. So this is going to be an uncomfortable ride.
It is. And I think the thing is that it was always going to be uncomfortable to some degree. But I think that some of the bumps could have been ironed out. You know, we could have, you know, we can still, you know, our leaders can still pursue different strategies.
Yep.
You know, that particularly in the West, where we do have the resources to do so. You know, different strategies where we prioritize the sustainability of growth, the sustainability of our economies. And I don't mean that necessarily from an environmental sense, but that's part of it too. I just mean from the idea that we can continue to grow the economy, to create jobs year after year after year, without having to spend nearly $100 billion on equity, mate, or to run these huge deficits, just to be able to give people a good life. You know, to be able to provide people, you know, a good life, for them to be able to pursue their hopes, pursue their goals, pursue what they want. You know, and I don't just mean that in like a, you know, sort of UBI sense, but just people to be able to live their lives without having to worry about the entire system coming crashing down around them. Mm. You know, yeah, I won't rant on.
No, but the point is that what you're really saying is that there needs to be a new set of KPIs. There need to be a new set of accountabilities. And it goes right back to what we've said on a number of other shows, that you've got to determine what you think the key objectives are, right? And if it's actually about the cohesion of society and the well-being of society, that's a whole different ballgame from the one that we've been playing for the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah, exactly. And that sort of, you know, that raises the issue, shall we say, of what happens to the economies after. You know, we are going to have some form of recession, that much is, you know, relatively baked in at this point, you know, as, you know, the world, you know, I mean, bar some sort of insanely large stimulus effort here in Australia, which, you know, admittedly cannot be ruled out considering what we've seen.
Mm.
But the question is, what comes after? Or, you know, are we just going to reflate the bubble with more QE? We're just going to throw more money at the housing market and, you know, hollow out growth even more? And I, you know, what do you do? You know, do you just keep, you know, going to the same well, even though the well is dry, even though you've well and truly hit the point of diminishing returns, you know, or do you just let the whole thing fall over and just rebuild and start again with something different, something better? I mean, perhaps I hope that's the route that our leaders will take, that maybe even the RBA will realize that the law of diminishing returns is well and truly upon them, and they should just let the whole thing fall over. They can build another bubble, a better bubble.
Build a better bubble. That could be something on a T-shirt, I think. But the point here is that if you actually think about it, you know, the few percent are still doing very well, right? And so, you know, the wealth inequality has got worse and worse and worse, right? So unless we can actually, in our next generation of definition of how the economy is going to work, we tackle that, then we're never going to get anything other than just a bit more of bubble reinflation and just do the same thing again and hope for the same outcome. In other words, more wealth at the top and everybody else suffers, right? But that's inequitable and it's not appropriate. The question is, where are the leaders, you know, emerging and current, who actually want to stand up and say, hang on, there's a different road? I don't see them yet.
No, I mean, I look at some of the historic examples and part of me wonders if you just need an absolutely painful level of crises to really get people to look outside of the mainstream. I mean, if you look, say, for example, at Greece, you know, it, and I'm not suggesting that what followed, you know, in terms of Greek governance was in any way good, because it really wasn't fantastic, but it did force people to look outside the major parties, to give other parties and other options a chance. Now, they completely didn't deliver on democracy. They made a mockery of it, frankly, you know, and they should go down and be condemned for all of Greek history. But I think that it is important that, you know, that some other political force, you know, comes up and at the very least forces our existing power structure to address some of these problems because they're not being addressed. I mean, you know, has our new Prime Minister spoken at all on the rental crisis yet? I'm not sure if he has.
No. I keep highlighting it's you know, 2 million in rental stress already. That's more than mortgage holders, right? 2 million and rising. And the mortgage stress data this month went through the roof because people are putting the rents up. So, no, you're right. People aren't focusing on the right things. We need strong leadership. We need visionary leadership. I don't see it, unfortunately. So welcome to the welcome to the madhouse.
I think we've been in the madhouse for a while. You know, it's unfortunately hard, it's a little bit hard to escape. But I mean, all you can do is just, you know, get your head down, hope for a better tomorrow, and just focus on the positive things in your own life and the positive changes that you can affect as an individual, you know, in your family, in your community, and all those different things. Because, you know, if you're relying on, you know, political leaders here or anywhere else to come to the rescue to fix things, then you may be waiting a while.
I think that's a very good advice, Tarek. Thank you very much for your time today and for your charts. We got through all 20 in a little bit longer than normal, but not too bad. Very important messages, though, and we'll do it all again soon. I'm sure there'll be more to talk about.
Definitely, mate. There's always I'm always cutting things out. There's always too much.
Take care. Keep well.
Yeah, you too, mate.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye.